I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual spring membership drive. At KBOO, radio is our business, and you can help our radio hive thrive this spring drive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to make a donation today. Be sure to give by May 28th to help us reach our $56,000 goal.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News... The masks are back on for Multnomah County as a new COVID subvariant spreads rapidly. Flags are lowered in the memory of a million lives lost to the pandemic. And it's voting season in Oregon. How the state compares to others in opening access to the voters. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 12, 2022. I'm Annette Newell, so glad you could join us tonight. It's election season, and many Oregonians will find it easy to cast their ballots, even if they're experiencing houselessness or on parole. It's an easy state to vote in, as one of only eight that conducts their elections completely by mail. But as Eric Tegedoff reports, some say that Oregon could take even more steps to ensure that everyone in the state can vote.
Oregonians have the easiest time casting their votes in the nation, according to studies, and can vote in almost any situation. Open access to the ballot will shape Tuesday's primary and a pivotal midterm election after that. State residents vote by mail, reducing many barriers people often encounter at polling places. However, this can present a challenge for people experiencing homelessness. Molly Woon is a senior advisor to Secretary of State Shamia Fagan and says these folks can use the address of the place where they spend most of their time. and have their ballots held at their local county clerk's office.
You can use the address of a shelter, you can use the address of a park, you can use the address of really any coordinates on the map, and that's what we will use to determine what district you live in and who you can vote for.
Woon also notes that people are able to have their personal information shielded as well. This is important for people who are involved in cases of domestic violence, for instance. Woon says they can speak to their county clerk about how to set this up. Ilana Wilson is head of Next Up, a youth-led organization that was instrumental in securing automatic voter registration in Oregon. She agrees that the state is easy to vote in, allowing people who are on parole or even in jail to cast their ballot. But Wilson says Oregon could go further and join Maine and Vermont, where people can vote from prison.
I think that that's where people get it confused, is that this is punishment and you lose your citizenship. But that's not the case. And if you are a citizen, based on the rules within our society and within our country, you should still have the rights of a citizen. That includes the right to vote.
Wilson says it's important to bring voting rights to Oregonians who have been left out so far.
Breaking down those barriers and being really intentional about centering folks who have been intentionally marginalized from this vote and changing our society really is core to making our society and our democracy real.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A new COVID surge of an even more contagious subvariant has Multnomah County health officials urging people to put their masks back on indoors. COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are spiking again as the BA2 version of the Omicron variant makes its rounds. This time, it's not a mask mandate, but a strong recommendation that people wear masks indoors until the numbers drop back down to lower levels. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vine says, quote, "We are asking everyone to put their masks back on for a few weeks as they go to school, work, and other indoor events." She says the goal is to minimize the spread of the illness so that people can stay well and can attend all of the spring events they've planned. She says in the context of schools, the academic success, social well-being, and mental health of the kids should be a top priority. So that's why she's encouraging masking in schools and that everyone who's eligible is encouraged to stay up to date on vaccinations, practice good hand hygiene, and stay home when sick, regardless of testing negative for COVID. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has ordered flags lowered to half staff in the memory of the 1 million Americans who have died from COVID-19. Brown decreed that all flags at Oregon public institutions will be flown at half staff until sunset on May 16th. She says this honors the 7,548 Oregonians killed in the pandemic. "Every life lost to COVID-19 is a tragedy," Brown said. "With about 1 million Americans who have died from this virus, there are too many families who are now without a friend, family member, or other loved one. Dan and I are keeping all those who have lost someone to this disease in our hearts. I hope that as we remember all those we have lost, we collectively continue to help protect each other from this disease," the governor said. President Biden warns world leaders not to relax when it comes to fighting COVID-19. With more on that story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
President Joe Biden spoke to world leaders today at the second global COVID-19 pandemic summit. The U.S. is hosting the summit along with Germany, Indonesia, Senegal, and Belize. One goal was to bolster a lagging international commitment to addressing the virus. The coronavirus has killed more than 999,000 people in the U.S. and at least 6.2 million people globally, according to Johns Hopkins University. The president called on Congress to urgently provide an additional $22.5 billion for testing, vaccines, and treatments. Biden said the lack of funding and what he calls critically needed money is a U.S. reflection of faltering resolve, and it jeopardizes the global response to the pandemic. The first COVID summit took place about 8 months ago. At the time, Biden pledged the U.S. would donate 1.2 billion vaccine doses worldwide. The U.S. has shipped nearly 540 million vaccine doses to more than 110 countries and territories. Since, the sense of urgency on the part of the U.S. and other nations to respond to COVID has waned. Momentum on both vaccinations and treatments has faded. Biden said, quote, "This summit is an opportunity to renew our efforts to keep our foot on the gas when it comes to getting this pandemic under control and preventing future health crises," end quote. Summit leaders announced about $3 billion in new money to combat the virus. This was a far more modest outcome than at last year's meeting. The biggest problem now is logistical support to get patients vaccinated, not vaccine supplies. This includes lack of refrigeration and syringes and insufficient healthcare workers to give the shots. More than 680 million donated vaccine doses have been left unused in developing countries because they were expiring and couldn't be administered quickly enough. Fewer than 16% of people in some of these countries have been immunized. As of March, 32 poorer countries had used fewer than half of the COVID-19 vaccines they were sent. U.S. assistance to promote and facilitate vaccinations overseas stopped earlier this year. Biden has now requested about $5 billion for that effort. Congress has balked at funding the COVID-19 relief package, at least partly related to political opposition to the impending end-of-pandemic-era migration restrictions at the U.S.-Mexican border. Biden warned that without congressional action, the U.S. could lose out on access to the next generation of vaccines and treatments, and that the nation won't have enough booster doses or antiviral treatment drugs. He also said more variants will spring up if the U.S. and the world don't take action. Biden declared at the summit, quote, "This pandemic isn't over," end quote. He referenced 1 million empty chairs around the family dinner table. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Many Washingtonians have been cooped up during the pandemic, so a barbecue for the community aimed at bringing people together again. And it featured Doug Baldwin, who won the Super Bowl with the Seattle Seahawks in 2014. Eric Tegedoff has that story.
The pandemic has kept Washingtonians apart for the past 2 years. With COVID-19 numbers down, an event in Renton is aiming to bring people together again. The annual community barbecue is a partnership between the United Way of King County and Doug Baldwin, the Super Bowl-winning wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. Baldwin also is the campaign chair for the United Way of King County. He says the idea for the event is simple: bring people together in a family-friendly atmosphere.
You got a whole bunch of people who are just kind of clamoring for that opportunity to get back together with their family, with their friends, with their neighbors, with the community in general. And what better way to do that than over some barbecue?
The event is June 18th at Renton Memorial Stadium. It's going to feature music and activities, including from the Kids Quest Children's Museum and Lego Guild. Baldwin says people's inability to get together has taken a toll, and quotes his friend Brené Brown, a researcher and author.
When there's a lack of connection, there's ultimately suffering, right? And I think we've all experienced that to some degree. And so this is kind of addressing that. This is getting back to a healthy level of connection.
Baldwin says he has a personal connection with this kind of get-together, noting Grandpa always loved to barbecue.
You could smell the barbecue and the fire in the front of the house before you even got to the backyard. And it was a special time where you just get together with your friends and with your family and get to catch up on life and share it over a good meal.
He adds that it's $10 per plate, but no one will be turned away if they can't afford the $10 for food. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The leak of a Supreme Court draft opinion indicates that a majority of the justices would eliminate federal-level abortion protections. A final ruling on the matter is expected within the next 2 months. Many Republicans are saying they'd support the ruling if it becomes final and overturns the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. The issue is galvanizing opposition from Democrats and others who support reproductive rights. For some deeper perspective, I talked to Oregon State University history professor Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols.
It is. Well, I mean, I think essentially what you're seeing here in this ruling is to suggest there will be a 15 states that in which it's legal. And that's where most women who can go to get these procedures. You'll see
women,
something like
women with money.
Women with funds, women with capacity to do that, right? And then you see something like 15 or so states with large, if not entirely prohibitive, exclusions against any abortion. And you'll see some middle ground in a number of the other states, however many remain, and all of which will fall disproportionately against, as you note, right, people who do not have the resources, who cannot leave their jobs for several days, who don't yet know if they are pregnant. I mean, and the other, there's so many dimensions to this, but one piece is that they're, you know, that the rulings suggest that people will be aware of their own pregnancy so early contradicts what so many of us know about what it means to become pregnant and You know, it seems one of the things that people have said about Alito's ruling, which I, in scanning the ruling, I find to be true, is that it has a kind of indignant lack of empathy for women and a kind of odd amnesia about what it means to be pregnant in the in contemporary society, in work, in life, that frankly suggests that this is not the kind of individual you want ruling on something so important for so many other people in the society. That someone who had studied the issue more, say in the history, someone who had more personal experience of this, might be able to at least craft a ruling that had meaningful exclusions or something along those lines, rather than something quite this absolute, which is really why everyone is shocked right now, because it's as close to 100% as you could imagine. In terms of the history, getting it wrong, in terms of the policy implications, including, you know, undermining lots of other rights that we take for granted today, frankly, and that are now threatened as well.
Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, all under oath, said that this was a precedent and that they would basically, to get confirmed, they lied, is what everybody is saying now. And is there any, I guess, not any recourse to go back?
No. Technically, there would be. Supreme Court justices can be impeached, and that would take a high bar. You'd have to go through the same things that we've seen and twice with Donald Trump and the president. It's basically the same kind of procedure. I can't imagine that would happen. But even if you opened impeachment hearings, that might be useful in its own way, just to remind justices that as they're coming in, rank lying, as this suggests, because Amy Coney Barrett was just confirmed a little over a year ago, is not permitted. It shouldn't surprise us. The court is inherently political at this point. It shouldn't surprise us that in order to be confirmed, they need to obfuscate a lot. We've seen this, all of us who've watched hearings over the years. I teach hearings. I talk to my students all the time. Look at how the tone has changed. Look at how they're not answering questions. We have these great conversations about that. I think one thing that this leak suggests is that the court is now inherently political. The old illusions about an apolitical court or judicial neutrality really don't hold anymore. I don't know who fully believes them. And I know at some levels, I know some fantastic judges who think that they can be pretty neutral, and maybe they can. But at least at the Supreme Court, it's another appendage of politics in many ways. And now recognizing that, I'm not sure where we go from here. But this seems to be, if it's not the final nail in the coffin of that illusion of judicial neutrality, it's awfully close.
And again, that was part of my conversation with Oregon State University history professor Dr. Chris Nichols. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Tonight's weather, clear to partly cloudy, a low dipping to around 35. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with rain developing later in the day, a high of 58. There's a good chance of the rain lingering through the weekend, a bit warmer on Saturday, up to 64, then 68 on Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1926, the Norge became the first aircraft to fly over the top of the world. Richard Byrd and Floyd Bennett braved powerful Arctic winds as they earned the right to say they were the first to fly over the North Pole. The quote of the day comes from Byrd, who said, "The easiest way a man can make a monkey of himself is to take up Arctic explorational work by airplane." This is Mental Health Awareness Month with the theme of Together for Mental Health. Advocates are asking California Governor Gavin Newsom to prioritize behavioral health programs in the May budget revision, which is due next week. Suzanne Potter talked to the president and CEO of Parents Anonymous, which runs a parent and youth helpline.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and advocates are hoping Governor Gavin Newsom will prioritize the issue in his revised budget due out by Sunday. The governor's January budget proposed $4.7 million to fund the California Parent Youth Helpline annually for 3 years, where people can connect with a trained counselor for free from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. Dr. Lisa Payan-Berlin is president of Parents Anonymous, which runs the helpline.
With greater resources, we could have more trained clinicians to answer the phone. The demand outstrips our capacity right now. We have people on waiting lists to get into our free online weekly support groups.
The service has helped more than 40,000 people in California since it started 2 years ago, but they'd like to help more of the Golden State's 9.3 million children. People can call the helpline number 855-427-2736 or go to the website caparentyouthhelpline.org. Last week was Children's Mental Health Acceptance Week, when people are encouraged to take action and reach out to another person who might be struggling. Payan Berlin says no one should be blamed or shamed when they ask for help.
Parents need support in identifying and accepting that change in behavior, mood swings, sleeping patterns, change in friends that their children look sad, that they may need to seek help.
A 2021 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that child suicide rates have been rising in recent years and that suicide is the eighth largest cause of death amongst children aged 5 to 11. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Earning a college degree increasingly requires a part-time job, and more than 40% of today's college students have full-time jobs. An equal amount, 40%, are 25 years of age or older. The pandemic and a strong job market have reduced college enrollment, but studies show college graduates will earn almost $1 million more over the course of their careers. Now, some universities are using creative strategies and flexible coursework to boost enrollment, as Roz Brown reports.
Many U.S. college degree programs can take years of full-time study, a serious time crunch for working adults. That's why more universities are offering flexible coursework options to improve enrollment, especially in rural areas. Reporter Nick Verrizos covers higher education in rural America. He says 40% of today's college students have full-time jobs, which causes some to back away from higher education.
The biggest issue facing a lot of rural education and a lot of rural students is that they haven't been given the awareness of what is available and what is actually possible for them.
Nationally, 7.5 million of the nearly 20 million college enrollees for fall 2020 were going to school part-time, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. According to the USDA, people living in rural areas have increased participation in higher learning over time, but the numbers have not kept pace with urban gains, especially in college and postgraduate education. Fariza says with mounting student debt, tuition, and living costs, more students want to see a direct connection between their initial classes and the careers they're pursuing.
I think it's a mistake to focus too much on how can we convince people this degree is good for you, and instead saying, hey, what are your needs and how can we meet them?
Because the definition of a typical college student is changing rapidly, Fariza says some institutions are exploring the idea of adding 3-year bachelor degrees.
What we're typically finding more and more of is for rural students, higher education really means part-time education.
Institutions piloting 3-year degree programs include the University of North Texas and the University of Minnesota in Rochester. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. Support for this reporting is provided by Lumina Foundation. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Senate rejects federal abortion protections. Republicans want the Justice Department to investigate protests against Supreme Court justices. And President Joe Biden plans to help farmers get more food on the shelves. With more on the stories affecting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Sadly, the Senate failed to stand in defense of a woman's right to make decisions about her own body.
Vice President Kamala Harris was in the upper chamber as Senate Republicans, joined by Democrat Joe Manchin, blocked a bill that would codify federal abortion protections. Republicans argued the legislation infringed on religious liberty in state laws, with James Lankford of Oklahoma using a large photo of a baby to make his case against abortion.
Equity, privacy rights, bodily autonomy, health care decisions, freedom to choose, reproductive rights, basic civil rights. All those are euphemisms for she dies.
A group of House Democrats led by Representative Rashida Tlaib marched to the Senate before the vote.
My body, my decision. My body, my decision.
The conservative majority on the Supreme Court is expected to strike down the Roe v. Wade decision this summer. The governors of Maryland and Virginia, along with Republican leaders, are calling on the Justice Department to investigate protests outside the homes of U.S. Supreme Court justices. House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik criticized Democrats for not condemning the protests.
What makes Republicans consistent is we speak out against violent acts, no matter who commits them.
Many Democrats have defended the protests as peaceful and lawful. Final congressional approval of a $40 billion Ukraine aid bill seems certain within days. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said funds will allow Ukraine to get more weapons and equipment, plus help investigate war crimes by Russia. The Senate is likely to vote next week on a $48 billion small business aid package. It would help restaurants and bars, businesses and ferries, gyms, minor league teams, live event support companies, and border region businesses that saw big revenue losses during the pandemic. Inflation eased slightly during April to 8.3%, but remains close to a four-decade high of 8.5%. The Labor Department also reported a leap of 9.4% in food prices, the largest 12-month increase since 1981. In Illinois, President Biden spoke about how the federal government will support farmers to ensure the food supply is secure.
As a big company's made massive profits, the prices you see at the grocery stores have gone up, and the prices farmers receive has gone down.
The White House plans to increase the number of counties eligible for insurance for double cropping and invest more in domestic fertilizers. Republican voters in Nebraska picked Jim Pillen as their nominee for governor instead of former President Trump's backed candidate. However, Trump-endorsed candidates won primary races in West Virginia for the U.S. House Tuesday. A judge blocked an attempt by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to remake the state's congressional map because of the way it distributed black voters among several districts, diminishing their ability to elect representatives of their choice. DeSantis pushed a map that would boost the number of Republican-held seats and dismantle a seat held by a black Democrat. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Interior Department releases the first volume of its report on its boarding school investigation. With that story and more, here's National Native News.
The U.S. Department of Interior released the government's first ever attempt to quantify atrocities committed at federal boarding schools for more than a century and a half. Completed largely by indigenous staff members, the document released Wednesday acknowledges the boarding school's role in carrying out the official U.S. policies of dispossessing Native people of their land and driving out Native languages, cultures, and spirituality, primarily by forced assimilation of Native children. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, a member of Laguna Pueblo, ordered the report last July after revelations of unmarked graves, presumably of students, on the grounds of former residential schools in Canada. Haaland says the report is the start of a path toward reconciliation.
I come from ancestors who endured the horrors of the Indian boarding school assimilation policies carried out by the same department that I now lead. This department was responsible for operating what we now know to be 408 federal boarding schools across 37 states or then territories, including 21 schools in Alaska and 7 schools in Hawaii. Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
Haaland became emotional as she described the trajectory of her own life. Her grandparents were sent to boarding schools when they were 8 years old, and now she is in a position to create what she hopes will be a foundational document for future healing.
The fact that I am standing here today as the first Indigenous cabinet secretary is testament to the strength and determination of Native people. I am here because my ancestors persevered. I stand on the shoulders of my grandmother and my mother, and the work we will do with the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative will have a transformational impact on the generations who follow.
The report is overseen by Deputy Assistant Secretary Brian Newland, who also fought back tears as he recounted the lost cultures, languages, and relatives, a trauma, he says, with echoes that continue to reverberate.
This has left lasting scars for all Indigenous people. There's not a single American Indian, Alaska Native, or Native Hawaiian in this country whose life hasn't been affected by these schools. We haven't begun to explain the scope of this policy era until now.
Newland says the pandemic hindered the department's ability to obtain documents needed for the report. He also says the inability of Congress to agree on anything more than a continuing budget resolution for much of the year limited the funds available. He recommends additional appropriation for research in the coming fiscal year. Looking ahead, Interior officials say the report is the launch pad for renewed efforts aimed at, among other things, language and cultural revitalization. The first steps of many, they say, toward repairing an era of dehumanizing transgression. At the press conference, Deb Parker, the chief executive officer of the National Boarding School Healing Coalition, said the report reaffirms the stories all Native people grow up with.
Our children had names. Our children had families. Our children had their own languages. Our children had their own regalia, prayers, and religion before Indian boarding schools violently took them away.
Secretary Holland says she will now embark on a year-long listening tour of the country to, in her words, elevate survivors and give them opportunities to share the stories and build a permanent oral history. She says it is her responsibility and legacy as a Pueblo woman to do so. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 12, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips. Here's the number, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad you could join us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text